You don't have to be an engineer to be a director, but when it's your project and your vision, you should have an idea of what you want to hear and what you don't want to hear. Jane Pipik will take you through an intro to sound, recording techniques, and studio production.
Some things to remember are, when you go in to do your production, what kind of sources are going to be available to you? Reel-to-reel tape machines, cart machines, cassette machines, mic inputs, phone patches, turntables. The next thing to look for is the quality and format of your mastering recorders. How advanced are these tape recorders that you're going to make your master on? So if you're going to do a radio production and you want to distribute this radio program over the air, you want to get as good and clean a quality master as possible. There are different formats for mastering tape recorders. Full track, two track, four track. Those are probably the ones you'll work with most on your initial recordings and radio programs that you produce, perhaps. Full track, that means that one signal, one mono signal, comes into the tape recorder and is recorded completely on the tape machine. Half track, which is another term for two track, is when you have two separate signals recorded on the tape. Here's a quarter inch tape, that's a regular tape. If it was a full track recording, signal would be recorded completely on one track. If it were a half track, it would have one track up here, one track down here, signal would be recorded on this track, signal would be recorded on that track. If it were a four track, it would be the same tape, and there'd be four different signal paths recorded on it. One thing to look for in a studio is, what do these machines look like? Are they clean? Are they? You can ask your engineer when they got them. How much use do they get? How old are they? Do you line them off? And do you have regular maintenance? Just to make sure that your equipment's being properly maintained and taken care of. And another thing in terms of your mastering is, as a producer, you need to ask the technician what kind of tape is set up to be recorded on their machines. Some people go to, you know, Crazy Eddie's and buy a reel-to-reel tape and go into a studio and say, here's my tape. Well, that tape may not be set up and aligned and made ready to work on this machine. So when you go to work with your engineer, say, what kind of tape do I need? Do you have it here in the house? Do I need to go buy it? In-house means in the studio. Do I need to go buy it somewhere? How much is it going to cost me? And try to get like a budgetary assessment. Now, the most important thing in terms of production, as far as I'm concerned with producers, is their ability to listen to what is being done. To me, that's the most critical thing that I, as an engineer, and producers have in common, that we're trying to listen to make sure we're doing quality work. So point three says right here, cart noise, turntable rumble, wow and flutter, hiss, hum. These are things to look for. For instance, I just did a recording in New York where I had to hire a studio. I went into the studio and the left output of their console had a big buzz in it. It's been there for a while, they just haven't fixed it yet. Now, was I going to go and record in that studio where everything I did was going to have a little buzz underneath all these voices? No, I left the studio because I didn't want my tape to be recorded with a major fault in it at the very beginning. There's like no way you can get rid of those kinds of problems. So you, as a producer, when you're in the studio, listen, you know, that to me is the most important thing. If you hear something that you think is wrong, ask to hear it again. It's your right, you're the producer, you're in charge of the overall recording, and if there's something wrong with one piece of the equipment, it's your right to either change that piece of equipment or go to another format, you know, move around so you don't have to use that. Something that's real important is in terms of your operation of equipment when you go to a production studio. If you're going to be doing multi-machine mixing, which is playing back from one source into another and another source and then recording over here, we're going to play back a fire scene and the firefighter's voice and record it over here. You want to know if it's going to be easy and quick for the engineer to run the mix. And some things that make it easy and quick to run the mix are such things as remote control. So as I'm sitting here if I want to start the turntable, I just pull this up and the turntable automatically starts. Or some consoles have like push button start, stop, fast forward right there, so the engineer can sit there and do the mix all at one time, and they don't have to lean over and run it here and there.
Now, David Ossman, Vanessa Whitburn, and Mark Decker discuss how the director and engineers come together to work as a team.
In radio theater, this is related to my statement about studios being built to record music and voice close mic'd in. They're not really built for radio drama. Engineers aren't really built for radio drama either. Most engineers have spent a lot of money and a lot of time being trained to record sounds perfectly. All radio theater involves a degradation of sound. And because you always want to make what you record sound like it someplace other than in front of a microphone in a studio. So engineers have to go through this period of retraining in order to understand that what you want is an imperfect recording.
It's called deprogramming.
Regrooving, exactly. Is what you want is what you hear, and what you hear is usually not what you get off a microphone from a sound booth in a studio.
We then meet with our sound effects technician, who is usually the senior technician, like Mark. He has read the script. Now, I cannot stress this enough, but if you're doing drama, or even documentary drama, as opposed to a chit-chat show or something, or a chat show, do get them to read the script, because when I first came to work, they said to me, oh, no, we don't need to read the script. You just tell us what mics to fade up and down. I mean, is it one and two or three and four? Because a crossfade's a crossfade, and a quick fade's a quick fade. And I said, look, I won't work like that, because two things. One, by the time I've told you, it's too late. There's a delay, you know, cross, and it's too late. Two, there is a difference between, if you crossfade between a crying baby and some soft music, and if you crossfade between racing horses and a dripping tap, it will be different. It's like music. It's a different kind of crossfade. So it's good if your technician knows that it's a crying baby and a dripping tap. This is not a kind of segue pop show where any old crossfade will do. They are musicians. They are, as much as your actors are musicians, they are, your technician is a musician. And if he is crossfading on the panel, what you call the desk, or if he is crossfading at the tape console, it is good if he or she knows what they are crossfading, the ingredients, so that they know. So get them to chat about it, and then we have a meeting. And what, Mark, do you like to know from me?
I think, really, it's how Vanessa conceives the whole project. If it's a historical thing, then we're not going to make it fast and zappy and have put music all over it, and the style, the approach that Vanessa wants to take, because that then gives me an idea of how I'm going to approach it in the studio. Do we want to do very long takes? And then when I'm talking about very long takes, we can be talking 30 pages at a time. Sometimes it is necessary for the mood of the piece to actually do that as a continuous run all the way through. And I need to know that so that I can lay out my studio so I don't have it unless it is absolutely essential, so that we go from one scene, which is over there, and the next scene is over there, and they've got a half a mile hike to get to the next set of mics. If possible, we will set it out so that they can go continually, so that the actors don't have to think about technical things, technical tricks of holding the mood while they leave this microphone, so that when they can then do an approach on that microphone, still in the same mood. If I can build it so that they can cross from here to there without stopping their flow, then we're not putting another constraint upon the actor.
You got a mic, I got a mic. We got a, you know, everything is plugged in right. And if you pay attention to the numbers on the mic, so you can say, well, what kind of mic is this, to the engineer. And he will say, this is an RE15, isn't it? No, it's an EV2, 685A. Whatever it is, they will give you numbers, you know, and you will never remember them if you're like me. You'll say 655A, A18, fine, TCD5. You know, it's all, and engineers love that. It's like the priesthood. It allows them to have a sort of Latin language that no one else understands but them, you know. What's important is that you understand that there are three basic variety kinds of mics and what they're used for, that there is an omnidirectional mic, there is a cardioid mic, There is a directional mic, and there is a shotgun mic, which is a super directional mic. And if you can ask your engineer, is this an omni? Am I going to get all the sound in the room? Is this a
direct? It's the one you want, trust me.
It's the one you want, trust me. Well, you see, the more you learn about that kind of terminology, the more you'll understand what he's doing. He could still do it, but you'll understand why he's doing it. There has to be a collaborative relationship, right?
If you don't tell your engineer what you want, they're going to go and say, well, I think you might want this. And then you'll do it, and you'll go, oh, my gosh, this isn't what I wanted at all. That's not how I heard it. So communication is really essential. Preparation, thinking to yourself, how do I want this to sound? How am I going to tell my engineer how I want this to sound? Getting all your reels ready ahead of time so your engineer can work with you to create what you're doing.
So, again, be prepared and do your homework. Know what sounds you need and know when to ask for advice.
Here's an example of a mix sheet that I got recently from a producer who had really thought out their mix. They put down all the events. For instance, a narration track where a WGBH stater comes in, where the events were coming from, the digital tape machine, another machine that had Dolby SR, ambience tracks, how long each cut was, and they planned out their whole two-hour mix completely and gave it to me as an engineer the day before and said, we're going to be doing this tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions?
You know, it's like a birthday present.
It's like a birthday present to an engineer, and we're usually not that lucky to get anything like that usually as well. Well, I don't really know how I want it to sound, and I didn't listen to the tape, and I haven't done any editing, and it's on this cassette, and I think it's distorted. Can you help me? You know, I mean, that's an engineer's nightmare. This is the right way to do it.
There are many ways and means to alter and fix sound, sometimes called sound or voice processing. Jane introduces the subject, and then engineers Steve D'Onofrio and Bob Pruitt take you on a tour of voice processing.
I want to go into outboard equipment first. Reverberation, delay units, compressors and limiters, filters, equalizers. Basically, these are things you can add to the sound.
You're listening to two voices in mono. Notice the VU meters of the left and right channels show equal levels.
Not only are the levels equal in volume, they are identical in phase. This is the characteristic of a mono signal.
Stereo signals exhibit differences between the left and right channels.
Notice, as I turn the pan control to the left, my voice moves to the left meter.
Notice, as I turn the pan control to the right, my voice moves to the right meter.
My voice is panned hard left.
My voice is panned hard right.
Hard panning produces dramatic left and right stereo,
but reproduces poorly in less than optimum stereo environments.
Not every listener monitors with headphones or in optimum stereo environments.
By only partially panning signals left and right,
stereo imaging still can be obtained with less than perfect listening conditions. My voice is panned 45 degrees left.
My voice is panned 45 degrees right.
Digital delay devices provide echo, chorusing, and flanging effects.
By delaying the signal more than 40 milliseconds, echo is heard.
This is a 50 millisecond delay. This is a 100 millisecond delay. This is a 200 millisecond delay.
Delays of 20 milliseconds to 40 milliseconds give a doubling of the voice without perceived echo.
By slightly varying the amount of delay, the doubled voice is given more unique character.
When using delays of 2 to 20 milliseconds, a phenomenon called flanging occurs. Varying the delay amount now causes a whooshing sound.
Delays of roughly a half a millisecond to 6 milliseconds
can also be used to provide a panning effect while feeding equal levels to both channels.
The dry signal is sent to one channel, and the pan delay to the other channel.
Continuous repetition of echo is produced by feeding the echo output back into the delay device.
This may be a knob or button on the delay unit, or you may need to patch it yourself.
Turning the variable delay knob during the program
will change the pitch of the program.
A real room has so many echoes that they blend together to form what is called reverberation.
A reverb unit imitates this dense cluster of echoes.
Delay and reverberation are time manipulation effects of sound.
Now we will discuss equalization.
Equalization is the boosting or cutting of particular frequency bands.
Your home stereo has equalization controls which split the audio spectrum in half. Treble, 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 treble. And bass, 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 bass.
A mid-range, mid-range, mid-range will be included on most mixers.
The audio spectrum ranges from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz and covers 10 octaves.
Graphic equalizers generally split the audio spectrum into the 10 octave bands or fractions thereof. 20 half-octave bands or 30 third octave bands are common.
People hear in 1/3 octave bands, and rooms tend to ring in 1/3 octave clusters, making 1/3 octave EQs the most useful in sound reinforcement.
EQs are used to create special situations.
A telephone sound EQ is made by boosting the frequencies from 400 hertz to 2 kilohertz and removing the frequencies below 400 hertz and above 2 kilohertz.
A presence situation is created by boosting mid-range frequencies around 2 to 4 kilohertz, making the voice seem closer.
An inside your head voice could be created by
accentuating frequencies from 125 hertz to 1250 hertz.
The controls on the graphic equalizer have fixed frequency centers and the bands are of a fixed width.
The parametric equalizer allows variable bandwidth, variable frequency center, and the variation of adjustment of level.
This allows boosting or cutting of very narrow bands like 60 cycle hum and its harmonics, or of a single feedback note. The signal now has several harmonics of 60 hertz on it. Here is a parametric equalizer removing first the 60 hertz component, now removing the 120 hertz component, now removing 180 hertz, and finally removing 480 hertz. From that to this.
Tape hiss on bad recordings may be reduced by lowering 10 kilohertz to 20 kilohertz, the uppermost octave, without too much effect on the program.
In general, equalization can be accomplished more subtly by cutting rather than boosting. Equalization should be used carefully because, like any external device, it adds some distortion and noise.
Compressors are used to create a more uniform volume level. They are, in fact, an automatic volume control, some with variable attack and release times.
The threshold sets the level at which automatic control occurs, and the ratio sets the allowed dynamic range during compression. My voice sounds thinner without compression. My voice sounds thicker with compression.
My voice sounds thinner without compression. My voice sounds much thicker with compression. An expander or gate pulls the volume down when the signal goes below the desired setting of the threshold. It is used to remove unwanted background noise.
Compressors and limiters are used to help the signal in case it is very, very strong and is stretching the capability of the tape to record it magnetically without something called distortion happening or clipping. Distortion and clipping are techie terms where the sound is breaking up, and that's a good thing to listen for as a producer in the studio. Do you hear it sounding back, playing back clean? Nothing's being clipped off. There's no breakup anywhere in the sound, in the person's voice, or perhaps the mix that you're listening to.
As an example, this is a fairly decent level, right about in the middle. Now, I'm too far on mic and being recorded too hot. Notice the distortion. When you're this close and loud, you get popped peas that sound like explosions and too many lip smacks and gulps, etc. Some of it's the actor's mic technique and some of it's engineering. This is distorted.
When I go into a studio to record voice tracks, I'm very careful to say, could I please hear that back? And I sit there and I listen and I don't talk to the engineer and I don't talk to anybody else. I sit and listen to the tape because that's what I'm permanently stuck with, that tape. And if it's not right, you say to the engineer, could you record that at a lower level? And that means they'll bring this microphone back into the console, they'll cut the level back. Perhaps if my voice is so loud, it goes up like this, and then perhaps it goes down, and doing a very dramatic reading, a person might use one of these things called a compressor or limiter so that when I go like that, it won't ride the levels over. It'll automatically catch it before it clips so that my tape over here sounds fine when I play it back. It's very hard to get a good single voice recording. I think it's one of the hardest things I, as an engineer, have ever done, to tell you the truth.
The silence and then
right, and then
the level.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult out in the field to do a good single voice recording. It's much easier to mix a rock band in a way because there's more things that will cover up the distortion in a way. Okay. Unity gain setup. Basically, we want all these sources to come into the console at a single, at the same kind of level. Can you give us an example of tone that helps us set up unity gain? Okay. The way an engineer sets up their consoles, they always put at the top of each tape a tone that sets up their meters here, and they set all their machines up to read back at this meter, at that tone. So they can, and if you go into do a production and your engineer doesn't put tone on, insist that they put a tone on, that if you have tone on that tape, you can take that tape to Australia, you can take it to China, any recording studio in the world, and they will then calibrate their machine according to that tone so that it plays back like it was recorded. That's the beauty of tone, is that it gives you flexibility. Many people neglect to put tone on their tape, so we don't know how it was recorded. If we put tone on the tape, it gives us an indication of what the level it was originally recorded at, and every engineer worth their salt will always put tones on their tape to give us a whole idea of how that machine was aligned and maintained and set up so that we can do a recording. That's something that's sometimes neglected in early production work. You kind of don't think about tone. You don't really know what it does. Why should we bother zeroing our meters, etc.? That keeps everything at what is called unity gain. It keeps all your levels very even. And the chances of distortion, clipping, are less at that point if you can keep your levels at a certain ratio. That's something that the engineer tries to keep track of, but you as a producer should make sure that your tape has zero BU, and you should be sure to watch the levels. If you're watching levels and they are like up here in the red mark over zero, you know that that engineer is distorting your tape. You don't even have to hear it being played back. It's not good. So that's another job I always tend to, if I'm a producer, keep looking at the levels and make sure they're not bouncing way above zero. An occasional peak into the red is okay, usually, but constant plus three kind of thing means distortion on your tape.
Now, Jane discusses a little more about production values and listening back.
Most of the time, production for radio work is done in stereo. It's more interesting to listen to if there's a height and a depth and a breadth to your radio drama. If it's all one voice hitting you here, 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 it's perhaps not as interesting sonically as it could be. However, in public radio, we are told, although I'm not quite sure if this is true, that a lot of listeners listen to stuff in mono. The lousy kitchen radio that's on top of the refrigerator behind the toaster that you turn on to listen to the news, you know, that kind of thing, that you listen on those kinds of sources. So if it's in mono, if you're playing the stereo source back in mono and it sounds good and clean and no distortion, then you know you've got a high-quality stereo signal, too, you know. That if it's fine in stereo, but then you put it to mono and it still sounds fine, you know you're doing something right. Always make sure your productions are played back at least somewhat in mono. You know, ask to hear 5 minutes back in mono, because sometimes in the combination of the recording, you can actually have some signal disappear when you combine it into mono. And that means that microphones have been set up incorrectly and that some of the information is combining in such a way that it's disappearing. The sound actually goes what is called out of phase, and you lose information. It's interesting how sound waves combine, and when you have an out of phase program, sound waves can combine in such a way that they create nothing. It's very weird. Very odd. And some, right, and usually it doesn't quite cancel everything out, but it cancels a lot out, and you're like, wait, that voice sounded so clear and deep and rich. No, it sounds so skinny and little and tiny, you know. This is a bad thing.
And in conclusion,
most engineers I know would give their right arm to make you happy, you know, to really give you the kind of mix that you want and take great pride in their work. They consider an artistic craft, similar to a musician who plays. You know, we're combining sounds to make a beautiful piece of art. You know, that's how I look at my work. I consider it a craft, a skill, and I consider producers a skilled crafts people too, artists that we're working together to make a beautiful piece of tape so that people can be moved in some way, whether it's laughing, crying, or having a good time.
We hope this tape has helped and challenged you as a radio theater director and producer. Remember, listen, listen, listen. Our thanks go to Jane Pippick, David Osman, Marjorie Van Haltern, Vanessa Whitburn, Mark Decker, Norman Gio, Steve D'Onofrio, and Bob Pruitt for their participation in MRTW workshops. For more words on directing, we invite you to listen to the MRTW Directing and Working with Actors cassette. The Midwest Radio Theater Workshop is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Missouri Arts Council, the City of Columbia Arts Commission, and KOPN-FM Radio. MRTW is directed by Diane Huneke and is located at 915 East Broadway, Columbia, Missouri, 65201. This cassette was produced and edited by Brian Price, and I'm Roger Studi. Thanks a lot, and let us know how your future productions go.